inside because you have complained about nature and how you hate the sound of birds chirping. I know who you are. Like, people have told me. I know that that's happening. I thought it was very nice. But
I liked it.
Alyssa liked it.
I like the birds.
And that's who we're speaking with today. This is Alyssa Morrison sitting across the table from me. And this series has been one where we've enjoyed hearing perspectives from some of the leadership in our community on already a range of topics. So I'm very glad to have Alyssa with us. Welcome.
Glad to be here, Jeremy.
Welcome. And we're going to jump right in. It's going to be, I think, a wide-ranging conversation today. And so those of you who are inclined to track that conversation with pen and paper, please do. Please do. So, Alyssa, glad to have you here and excited for the conversation. Tell me a little bit about what you brought to the table.
Yes. So I've been thinking a lot about the concept of power, and which is a very broad topic, so we might be everywhere. But I wanted to start with, in my undergrad, I remember learning about the three needs theory, which is a model proposed by David McClelland. And I think it's mostly used for like business management, like managerial. I think it's pretty popular. But I remember learning the three needs is basically like three human motivations. So what are humans motivated by? Not needs in a sense of like, you know, your physiological need, but like motivational. So the three needs are achievement, power, and then he says affiliation. And he's using affiliation, I think, as like intimacy. So like the desire for relationships, for agreeableness, for like a friendly sort of social interaction is what he's saying by affiliation. So those three, I remember learning about them and like trying to place myself on like which of those needs am I like, do I feel the most drawn to? And we learned it's like a sliding scale. So, all of us are a mix maybe of those motivations. Like you can obviously like to achieve and also like to be in control and have power and you like community, but maybe you're at different stages of your life too, in different places with those. So the degrees are different, but I specifically wanted to talk about power because I feel like power has, for one, it's timely. Like right now, I think power is an interesting idea to explore with everything going on and power dynamics being questioned and what is power? So that's what I wanted to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm glad for the framing. Achievement, power, affiliation. And who is that again?
David McClelland is his name. Yes, I think it's the 60s is when that kind of came out, and it's been kind of popularized since then. Like I said, mostly in like management and like the workplace. Right. So like how do bosses cater to like the needs or the motivations of their employees?
Right. So. Yeah, it strikes me that power structures have, I mean, in a sense, depending on what sphere in which you operate, right? Power structures are always being examined and challenged. But again, obviously, now more than ever, mm-hmm. you have these watershed moments where power is examined in essentially the public consciousness, right?
Yes.
I would say, I don't know what the last, and you know, maybe Me Too might have been, at least there might be others, but in my mind, maybe the last moment we've really examined power in that way was the Me Too movement. And that's, you know, a very complex thing because when power is examined, it's often reorganized,
yeah.
But kind of seems to not go away, right? I mean, it's
right.
Redistributed. You'll frame it how you will and lead us through the dialogue. But I take it, has your thinking about power changed in light of all of this? Or has this really uncovered kind of the, you know, your fundamental beliefs about power like that have been there all along?
I think in the last year, which one thing I want to talk about is the power being intimately bound to control, which I think is something that's obvious, but we might forget. And I think actually before the Black Lives Matter movement kind of really kicked off in the last few months, I was already thinking a lot about it because of my need for control. So I was seeing in the workplace and in my relationships some unhealthy tension within myself with power and control. And I think that that's what really started it. And then I read a lot of literature that also critiqued this sort of more like institutionalized or systemic or whatever power dynamic, but then also just like on the ground, like in your marriage, in your friendships,
mm-hmm.
like how are you running into like these power dynamics, and like what about, I guess power just seemed to be way more complicated than I always thought. Because the stereotype for me has always been like, oh, power hungry individual, or
okay.
like
a flattened notion of just,
yes,
right.
I think I had a very flat notion, or I'd be like, oh yeah, power in the system, man, like that kind of thing. But it was not ever like my own need for power or my own need for control and how that can get ugly.
Very
and,
interesting.
Yeah. And so I think I've been thinking about it a little bit more, and then of course I think it's been heightened and more like expanded. You used flattened. I think it's been, yeah, more complicated since everything else going on, which I think is good.
Yeah.
But interesting. Because there is like multiple dimensions. Like there's the more abstract sort of like, I like the collective consciousness sort
right.
of power.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's all critique this. And then there's like this in the self loss of power, control in your relationships. And that to me is very, like, almost, I don't know if I'd say just as interesting, maybe just as important.
There's a within without relationship to power, right? So where we experience it, and then where, how we evaluate it internally, but then how we see it and experience it externally as
yes.
well.
Yes, yes. And I think I've always been like, oh, I see it and experience it. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's all outside of myself,
mm-hmm.
power is. Or, like, I could be affected, but,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So even just basic examples of, like, coming into some interesting workplace issues with gender and myself. And being like, oh, that's like, a feminist thing. That's not, like, an Alyssa thing. And then having some really, like, altering experiences with, oh, I'm being treated, I feel like I'm being treated differently because
mm-hmm.
of my gender, and like, yeah, power kind of being something I can't step apart from all the time.
Right.
So
perfect. Well, that's a very good, I think, way to kind of, again, lay some groundwork for this conversation. So
power intimately being bound to control. That's like one point I think I wanted to explore. Based on some personal experience and then some reading that I've done recently. So even just like the basic reminder of lack of control in whatever sphere, like, makes us feel powerless, and kind of like, what are our instincts and where do we go when we feel that powerlessness and that lack of control? So I think, like we already briefly mentioned, like, just understanding that none of us are immune to the desire for control, and it's not necessarily like a negative to talk about power in a way that's like something that we naturally desire, or like control as something we naturally desire. Because I think I've had some very negative perceptions of that, and I think it's a complex term and idea, but how can we complicate this like seemingly natural instinct for maybe dominance or for control. So that's just something I was thinking a lot about when it comes to like the relationship between like power as a need to control others, or the need to control your environment, control in any aspect.
So do you think that, and I don't know how much time you want to spend on that observation, but do you think that the idea that power is used to control, power as a need to control, is that, whether it's based on your reading or your own experience, is that something that is a response to, do you see it as a response to other power structures? So in other words, because there are other systems of power that are necessarily controlling all of us,
mm-hmm.
Therefore, we really can't help but engage in it. So I guess, so I that's a very loaded,
yeah.
But the, I don't know what your thoughts are on that. But, and then also, and you kind of alluded to this a moment ago. So that first, but then also, is this a negative construct, or do you see it more as a neutral, or like how are you working through that idea? Because I imagine, I don't want to assume things about the people who are listening, but when I'm hearing that stuff, you know, you hear language like already power is loaded, and I think actually it's,
yeah,
as you were kind of, I think, alluding to, it's seen as a negative. And I'm very interested to know where you're at on that, how you view it. But then also, certainly control is seen that way. So
mm-hmm.
where does the power control dynamic come from, or how do we, is it a response? I'd like your thoughts on that. And then also, how should we view it? Because this is an interesting time for people where it's like, okay, so how do I navigate the power that I have,
mm-hmm.
which is, by the way, like, worth even taking the time to begin to try to define.
Yes. Yeah. I think.
So deal with any of that or leave it all behind. Whatever you want.
I think the first point you said as far as like, is power, or what does it look like as a response to, as far as like the control and like need. I think that inevitably, like, which kind of flows with what I want to talk about with displacement or projection and how those psychological phenomenon happen because of our lack of control or because of our lack of power. I think it's inevitable that the systems that we're in, like, are going to, like, leak into our subconscious or
right.
consciousness.
Right.
And we could be doing a lot of things, which I don't want to sound spooky, but I feel like we could be doing a lot of things that are because of an economic structure, because of race, like religion, like how things are operating around us that we're not always cognizant of. So I think power, yeah, is bound to those, like, larger structures. Our leadership, like, power as, like, our leadership. And I think we could talk a ton about that. Like, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that seep into our day-to-day lives? But, yeah, I think the classic example of, like, the dad that comes home from work and, like, displaces anger at the job or at the system, you
mm-hmm.
know, onto his family
mm-hmm.
by abuse or by whatever the
mm-hmm.
negative response is. I think that's a good, you know, stereotypical example, though, of, like, how the system does affect you. Because in that example, maybe it's, I don't want to use the term capitalism in that broad of a sense, but, like, maybe it's the economic that's,
mm-hmm.
like, plaguing him, which is a system, and then it's kind of displaced onto the wife or onto the kids. And I know I had that experience growing up.
Very interesting.
So, and we could explore that a lot. Like, how many other people have had that experience
right.
of their parents who are providing, kind of, like, deflecting onto them at times when you're like, what's wrong? Like, why is my parent upset with me? Or, like, why is there a temper? Or why is there abuse?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good example of maybe how, yeah, how they're connected.
It's a very useful example. And I was trying to, I don't know, I was hoping to get, and we did, we made it. I wanted to get to at least 10 minutes before Foucault came in. But I mean, it's inevitable. One of the, and I think you even mentioned this in the text exchange leading into, but, and I'm sure you'll have commentary on this. I think one of the most important, and I think it's a useful discussion point for the center communities that are going to be talking about some of this content that Foucault brings to the forefront is that sovereign power, the power of the state, which is in itself very diverse, is far too narrow a way of thinking about power. And I think so when you get into these realms of, like, how power is covertly operating through systems and
mm-hmm.
really cannot be avoided, that's where, and by the way, and, like, still an open question if it should be avoided, but that's where we see
yeah.
these really curious, like, problems. Like, so, yeah, you know, like, why was this week stressful for this 12-year-old? She has no idea, but it might be because there's an economic pressure where certain powers are being exerted, and then the tensions from that are being displaced. And she will be as culpable in this eventually as she is currently the victim of it.
Mm-hmm.
So power is very, very elusive. And I think that's just like, we're certainly more than beginning now in the conversation, but that's a place to begin to like evaluate, like, am I even aware of the places where power is hiding? Because if we reduce power to just who can put one in prison or something, right?
Yeah.
That, by the way, in itself, very interesting. But like, if we reduce power to like the people who make the laws, we are, as Christ followers, we are oversimplifying this and doing a disservice to people in our lives and ourselves. And so
I agree. Yeah. The first thing I thought of, even with the 12-year-old example, which you were talking about, like maybe the economic or the another type of system, but even just like group dynamics, and anyone who in our community loves psychology, well, like maybe their ears. Caleb Boston ever listens to this, he'll be like, group dynamics. But the...
He's smiling somewhere. Knowing that you're saying, yeah,
yes,
that's right. Yeah.
With his hair. but I feel like even adolescence in the group, and like we could talk about that and how power, like that, I just thought immediately, like that 12-year-old also is just like plagued by the fact that every day he has to cope with the fact that they're in a group in school, and like the dynamics that exist, the power shifts that happen at all age, but especially when you're trying to like find yourself in a group and as an individual, which I think we all still continuously do.
Right.
So anyway, right. The group, even as something like in our community, in our circles, like power still flowing through that. And like, how does our conversation look? How do we construct ourselves in a group? How, anyway, that's
interesting
too.
You know, the Panopticon, which is this really, Bentham, so maybe I'm getting that wrong. This is an opportunity. I'll get a text correction on that. But, what's the famous, I can't remember the famous kind of pithy phrase that surrounds it, but it's not the cement, it's not the walls of the prison, it's all of the open space. It's the light, it's the fact that you don't know when you're being watched, but you're always being watched. You don't even know who is watching you, but you know you're always being watched. And it's not actually the closed in walls, it's the bars that allow that lack of somebody to construct their own notion of themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, I want to respect whatever kind of flow you've got, but you do have that issue of power. When you think about power as, say, you have the idea of like a surveillance state, but you also have just this idea of like technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we don't really have. So within community, you have eyes on you, but also, like at this point, culturally, you have eyes on you all the time. And that is its own, there's a power construct there that probably shapes our behavior.
Definitely. Especially with social media.
Absolutely.
And I know that could be, I don't know. I don't think it's a boring conversation. I know people throw out all the time, like, oh, like social media has some negative connotation with perception and like how you view yourself, how others view you, what you're creating, there's a lot of memes, you know, on how Instagram is different from Facebook, is different from Twitter, and you have these different like versions of the self,
right?
You're kind of like promoting, and even like your the self as promotion, that's a whole other thing. So
absolutely,
yeah, I love what you said about technology too, because I've thought a lot about that, and I've read not a lot of Heidegger, but some essays he has on technology. And it's very interesting because power is elusive, and there's so many different like ways we could talk about it. But I think technology / social media / progress are all ways that we're affected by power.
So I think that I think there's a question embedded in this, which is I think it's because I've been on the heels of those who have been, you know, with us through our time in Ecclesiastes, I think there's this question of how to think about, not only how to think about the powers that we have, but whether it pertains particularly to technology or community, how are we influenced by those forces? And I think specificity is really, really helpful here. The more specific one can get about how that shapes the self. It was something you were saying in maybe the first 5 minutes, which is in some ways we're always, I mean, kind of with the kind of scenario you gave about the dad who comes home,
mm-hmm.
like we're always really reacting to this.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, in that sense, I don't know if power struggle is the right word, probably not, but there's some reciprocal kind of interaction there.
Yes.
And so I don't know, I elaborate on any of that.
That is definitely, it's like what I've been thinking of. And I would urge like everyone in our community to think like what part of yourself causes feelings of powerlessness, or where, what area. And I think that takes some serious like reflection on what makes me feel loss of control. Like there's some big, like, you know, ideas, which you're trying to talk about specificity, but like your age, like your gender, your sexuality, your educational background, like, your vocation, like what part of the self to you makes you feel powerless, and like how do you respond to that in ways, and like what does that response look like in your day-to-day life? Like where do you feel yourself feeling inadequate, and then how do you respond to that powerlessness? And I think that kind of like starting with the self there, and maybe those are helpful categories, but they are big,
mm-hmm.
Can give you more insight on like why do I respond that way in my or in the workplace, like, why am I doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Or why do I feel the need to defend myself with my educational background? Or why do I feel the need to defend myself with my blue-collar job or my service industry job or whatever it is? Why do I feel not adequate? And I think that that is where a lot stems from as far as...
It's a really, really useful point. It's a very useful point because actually, as I hear you on this, you're essentially saying, like, however we evaluate these power structures, in other words, neutral, positive, negative, and probably there's some complex thing happening. There's some, right. And so, however we evaluate these, ultimately, you're saying that they can be catalysts for understanding the things that motivate us more clearly.
Yeah. Understanding self.
Right.
Yeah. Because then if you know more about that, then we can talk about responses and behavior.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like what's happened to me in the last year is I was noticing some responses and a need for control and some feelings of, like loss of control and, like, doing things that I didn't understand why I was doing them. And we could get into a lot of psychological stuff on that. But just, like, evaluating, like, okay, I think I feel loss of control or I feel powerless. And then what should be the appropriate response when I feel that way?
Mm.
Like, as a Christian, how do we respond when we feel powerless?
Mm.
And is, I would probably argue, that feelings of powerlessness are essential to the Christian narrative. So what does that look like? And does that mean we lay down? Like, I don't think so. Like, I think as far as, like, is power negative or positive or neutral? I think neutral is a scary word to say as far as power goes. Because there's a lot of things, like, what we were talking about socially and culturally right now, like gender and like sexuality and things that are really important that I would hate to be misrepresented as saying, I don't care about power structures that are in place that are like, you know, keeping, like suppressing things and like controlling things in a way that's not productive. But I also think that power is complicated. And if we think about the Bible, like what are some examples of, you know, positive power or like good leadership. Like
right.
If we think about the kings or we think about the judges, like what are some things we can like take out of the chest of our childhood and be like, oh, this was a good king.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how was David a good, you know, leader and also a not so good leader?
Mm-hmm.
And it's always complex, I think. So I think going back to the point you said about power as elusive is helpful, but I think it's a mix. Because of course you have to have leadership and power. I would hate those who are in power. I would hate for them to feel like they can't use the power for good, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Right.
But also I think you have more of a burden when you're in a position of power. So with race, we could talk about that too for a long time as far as like privilege and power and like how you, utilize that. But
yeah, I think that, I really appreciate one of the concerns that I have had And I hope, I mean, you talked about not wanting to be misrepresented. I hope that I'm clear when I say this. One of the concerns that has been ongoing is that when we face, whether it's a black swan event like COVID-19 or this, you know, horrific killing, murder, beginning with George Floyd and then expanding to questions of power. Mm-hmm. A concern that I have is that because people, I include myself in this, so this is not meant to be lecturous, like all of us are, I think, pushed into this kind of, there's a temptation to react.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think when we are merely reacting, we're probably not thinking as clearly as we should, which means maybe the good that we can do in sometimes really miserable contexts, in these cases very miserable and really horrific situations, like is potentially diminished. And so I'm in no way trying to put words in your mouth, particularly on something like this, but I appreciate the idea that actually reflecting more deeply on what is motivating us.
Mm-hmm.
Concerning shifting power, a challenge to power structures, like what's actually motivating us. So there's a psychological component to this, but there's this, again, awareness that, you know, as you said, like, okay, so we should be concerned about like language that power is neutral. I really do think it's like energy. I don't know that it's dissipated. It's going to be moving. And anytime it moves into other spheres or arenas, like new goods can come from this and new problems can arise.
Constant reevaluation.
And so I think that a less mature reaction is we just want less power. I don't think that's really understanding what power, how it works in our society or in a world or in ourselves. And I think it's too easy. It's not going to go away.
No,
right?
It's not. I mean, we've seen that throughout history.
Absolutely.
I feel like it's pretty self-evident. Say it's like not going to go away. Like,
that's
you're
right.
Not going to be able to like squash power in one way and not see it crop up maybe in
somewhere
another.
Else.
Yeah.
And haven't we seen this in our own lives where you, and we can use the most kind of localized examples. I don't know. You get a promotion and now you have people that are under you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a position where there are people that answer to you.
Exactly.
Have we not immediately seen, oh, whoops, I'm abusing power right now?
Yes.
And that's probably framing it into, I mean, it may not be as innocent as that, but we find ourselves using the power that we have.
Yes. Or we've talked a lot about hierarchical marriage. Like, just like examples like that where you're like, I love my spouse. Why do I feel like we are, like, I'm like subordinated right now? Or
right.
Why do I feel in this conversation like we're not aligned and I feel like I need to gain power.
Right.
Like I need to get the upper, I need to bring out the, you know, list of things they've done and like really balance the power in our relationship. And so, I mean, just another example, like a local sort of something we've talked about before in At Center. And I think that those are useful as far as power's not, I don't think it should demotivate us that power's not going to go away.
Right. No, I don't
that,
either.
I know, but I'm thinking about that. Like it shouldn't be, like, we don't do anything about some serious power imbalances and issues we should be, like, facing. But I think it's a little bit freeing in some sense and then not in another. It's, like, ecclesiastical, I guess, as far as, like, power is going to fluctuate and, like, always in the self, I think, because of control, because of our need to feel safe and feel in control.
Right.
So I'm interested in that and how, like, everyone in our community experiences that in their day-to-day life.
Absolutely.
Also bound a lot to like insecurity as well. Like what are some things we can identify within ourselves? And I already kind of listed some of those categories, but like that we're insecure about.
Mm-hmm.
And that could even be like parts of our personality and parts of, you know, it gets really interesting as far as like, what are some things that we feel like inadequate, insecure about and how are those displaced or projected onto our spouse, onto our best friend. And one thing I kind of wanted to talk about was Freud talks a lot about displacement and how that's kind of like a natural unconscious defense mechanism when you feel lack of power or when you feel insecure or unsafe, mm-hmm. Input kind of whatever there. But he talks about this twofold kind of like displacement of object. So displacement as kind of, what does he say? Like putting negative, taking your negative feelings and like projecting them onto something else. So if it's an object, it's kind of the dad example of like comes home from work, puts it on the wife as far as like his, you know, unrest with the job or with the grind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's displacement of object.
Mm-hmm.
And then something else I'm really interested in is displacement of, he calls it attribution. So a characteristic that one perceives in oneself but seems unacceptable is instead attributed to another person. So instead of like an object, it's like a part of yourself. So that you don't like. So as far as we're talking about insecurity, and you kind of, you take that and you project it onto whatever, blank, a system,
mm-hmm.
a person, but it's something in yourself you don't like. So I think that's an interesting distinction because on one hand we have, oh, the dad comes home and the economic situation, which is plaguing him, is projected onto the wife via abuse. And then you have attribution, displacement of attribution. I don't like that I am controlling, or I don't like that I am opinionated or outgoing or whatever it is. And so I'm going to take that and I'm going to put that on my, you know, best friend and be
right.
like, why are you so controlling?
Mm.
You know, why are
mm.
you? And so then you start to sometimes hate the object that serves as a reminder of the disgust or hatred within yourself. And that is very layered and interesting. And I think we all do that in some ways. And so I'd love for us all to like dive more into like how we feel like we're displacing attribution or how we feel like we're projecting a version of ourselves onto things or people or systems. And so I don't want to make any broad statements, but I feel like especially when there's this really impactful movement like Black Lives Matter, which is doing a lot of good to uncover and unearth a lot of things we're seeing as far as systematic power, it'd be a shame for us to like take some parts of ourselves that we don't like and project it onto that movement and make it about us. When so that's complicated. I don't want to say that. I mean, everyone has to like think about their own motivations with
right.
power, but yeah, the whole concept of taking your insecurity and projecting it onto something, showing up to the protest and doing good, but then also why are you there? And like, what is your motivation? And is it a displaced attribution? Is it something that you're like, I feel guilt, so I'm going to show up because I have to project like my, you know, insecure, like guilt feeling onto like this movement. And I think that's doing a disservice to the movement, but.
Yeah. Oh no, it's very exciting that you're, I think, wading into some of the most controversial territory we've touched on yet.
Also, just exploring. No,
just exploring.
No statements, I guess. On
this is
know.
Alyssa Morrison. No,
and
but,
if she is exploring.
No, actually, so I will. I have to say, I really appreciate this observation, and I want to affirm it because I've been thinking about it quite a lot. There's a few things I want to say on this, and get your read on it. So we'll specifically start with issues of people groups, race, Black Lives Matter in response to, the George Floyd killing. When it's fascinating because prior to George Floyd and now mm-hmm. as well, the layers of conversation around tokenism and exploitation, those were interesting and problematic
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
And please feel free to disagree with this as much as you like. But I'm troubled by, it's maybe too strong a way to frame it. I think that we should all, myself, all of us should be, we should all be reflective concerning the degree to which as we're working to establish some sense of self, and as you were discussing displacement, the degree to which we utilize tragedy or national tragedy, violence, to establish a sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to. So that is again. This is back to how to be a Christian who is mature. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we are all, our motives are always, as far as I can tell, some of them are, it seems to be the case that our motives are never fully known to us, and they're never totally pure. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying like, and when I have worked out all of this,
yeah.
at that point, I am in the place I can go protest. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm simply saying that.
Like, you're still doing good.
You're
I
still doing the thing.
Showing up, doing the thing.
On the drive home, though, later with in community, before, I mean, you want to create that room to evaluate what's driving it,
yes.
what's driving those motives, because I think it can be incredibly, there's something incredibly condescending and actually really, I think, disturbing about, and I don't think people are, I really hate the appeal to, like, the subconscious, right? Well, you're doing this, but you don't know that you're doing it, and I can't know that you're doing it, so we're just going to assume you are. Like, I'm not even really trying to do that. I'm simply saying, like, it's worth it's worth exploring to know exactly why we're being driven to do the things that we're doing, knowing that we're still doing good, but that our motives are probably they're not ever pure, and they're always diverse and often at odds with one another.
Right.
So I don't know if that, those are my words. I don't know how much you were trying to head toward that or touch on that, and I don't want to put you on the spot there, but like, I think that it's worth, when you think about power in abstraction or in large movements, like, of any kind, there's always risk, because that means that, whether it be a protest or a political party,
mm-hmm.
it means that two individuals standing side by side protesting the same thing, two individuals standing side by side voting for the same individual,
mm-hmm.
the same president, whatever, the motives and the ways they experience power are very
yes.
different. Yes,
right? And I think a good example, I think I am in agreement with a lot of this basically constant reevaluation of your motives and
right.
not saying there's any problem, yeah, showing up to the protest or partaking in an act, but then just constantly evaluating why you're doing it so you're not being more destructive by not knowing. Like, take and assimilating your identity to something that's not fully fleshed out, or assimilating your identity to something other than Christ. The concept of mixed motivations and the example of like two people voting for the same political party or the same candidate or something like that had me thinking about two people that both proclaim to be Christians and have very different ideas of what that means, what that looks like, what their response is to COVID, what their response is to Black Lives Matter. And I think recently in my community, with Christian and non-Christian friends, the question has been posed to me, like, how are you able to be a Christian during this? When you see the church, capital C, church, mm-hmm. responding in these ways. I think that's always difficult, but I think what Jason and I have actually talked a lot about is the individuality, and I think it goes back to identity. Like, how do I construct what it means to be a Christian? What do I think Christ says about these topics? And how is my motivation with this different than maybe someone else's? And not that I don't want to also become some sort of like elite, like we have Center Church has the access to, you know, Christ and no one else does or something like that. But I do think we should be more comfortable with the individuality of our faith and exploring like how our identity is enmeshed with Christianity and like what, are we going off of like external, like are we going off of the church in a large sense, or are we going off of like what we individually think Christ would say about this? And it's problematic because language is hard, because then you have someone who says, I'm a Christian, and you say you're a Christian, and it looks so radically different. And that's there's dissonance in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to sit with that, and it's anxious, and language is tricky, because then it's like, I'm a Republican, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat, you're a Democrat. And that could mean so many different
mm-hmm.
things. So language in general is elusive
mm-hmm.
and tricky. So I think that's all the more reason for individually us to examine our motivations and like constantly be like questioning what does it mean to be a Christian?
As I've been listening to the way you've been framing power in our current moment, really, I go back to, and I think there's an umbrella term that I was like trying to recall really, but so Foucault writes a book, I think near the end of his career, could be getting this wrong, but it's titled Knowledge Power. And probably other than Discipline and Punish, I mean, it would be the number one book I would recommend to people. He has a collection of lectures, but it would be the number one book I would recommend to people to look at on this. And he talks about two types of technology. He talks about the technology of domination. And this is the kind of, these are the terms kind of floating through my head as I'm listening to you thinking through this. So the technology of domination, and when he uses the word technology, he just means like the modes by which we are dominated. Mm-hmm. And this, by the way, these are sometimes institutions that we all love, mm-hmm. including like, these are institutions that we create, mm-hmm. right? So this is the moment where, what's that?
Communities.
These are communities.
Community is good. Community also can be a tool of domination.
That's right. That's right. So that's exactly right. Absolutely. So like, I think of like, you know, moments where I'll just try to use examples as close to home as possible. Like I think of moments where whether it's stuff I've done in like my professional life and education, right? So I that's where I've put all of my professional energy.
Example.
Right. And to run with Foucault for a second, I mean, I can't remember how, it's always more pithy than I can remember, but he basically says it's no surprise that prisons look like educational institutions, look like government institutions. He says it's no surprise that those institutions look like prisons.
Yes, in
this kind of clever, kind of pithy way. I mean, like, so I've spent, or let's take center as an example. There are moments.
Let's knock it down.
Right, here we go. No, there are moments within any institution or organization where you're recognizing that the decisions you've made collectively have become a technology where domination is happening. Basically where you are, and this is not meant to be a conversation where like, you know, people like leave feeling guilty or something. It's really not about that. I think that's too, again, a too cheap or like knee-jerk kind of a response, but
maybe just increasing awareness.
That's exactly right.
Parenting is a good example.
Parenting is
what you were saying.
Yes, parenting is
inherently good. Inherently full of domination and power dynamics.
That's right. That's right. It's a perfect example of that. And these moments where you're like looking at a decision you made, maybe not just you, but collectively. And you're like, actually, this decision, it can be a micro. This is a micro example. Like, why didn't we have this individual speak or teach during that series? Why did we read these four scholars and didn't ever touch those from that geography even, right?
Like, what is the canon? What is the representation? How are these things like collectively creating a version of power?
Yeah,
like,
how reality is framed.
Yeah.
And that is so Foucault calls the modes of domination, right?
Technology of dominance. Mm-hmm. Is that what you said?
Technology of dominance, yeah. And but he also then responds. And there are the technology, and this is what I was thinking of as you were speaking. There are the technologies of self, which he puts at odds against these other technologies. And those are, I don't think he would say this, but I see many of those as fundamental to the experience of being a mature Christian. It's exactly what you brought up, which is to say self-evaluation, critical thinking, critical modes of inquiry.
Empathy.
I mean, these are almost right out of Foucault.
Empathy.
I can't remember. Empathy.
Empathy in a way that's not cheap, in a way that costs something.
Yes, which I really appreciate that. And I think that, and I don't want to recycle something that, I don't want to say something I've just been saying for about a month now, but it's something that came up in a conversation Kate and I had maybe a month ago. And I don't think it was mine. I think I read it or heard it somewhere, but there's this idea of how to utilize power well. How do I, if power is something that can't be avoided,
mm-hmm.
This may put some distance between us on the way we think about power, but I would say that power is not even something that should be, not only would I say that power can't be avoided, I don't know that power, how to put this in a way that I don't want to miscommunicate, I don't think the goal of the mature Christian is like, how do I get rid of all of my power?
Interesting. I'm interested in that because I'm like, what does it mean to be meek? Like, what is, are we supposed to like give up the power?
Right. And I would love to disagree on that. That could be a place where we might. But to get to, I'm interested in the question of if power is inevitable, mm-hmm. how do I not abuse it? How do I use it well? Mm-hmm. And I think proximity is an important way to do that. So as complex as like, let's take something like because I think maybe you brought it up earlier, like as complex as something like Black Lives Matter is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or any, as complex as it is to vote or to live in a system, a capitalist system.
To go to the job, yeah.
To go to the job.
To choose to have a kid, mm-hmm. like literally
right.
anything, yeah.
Right. All of that very complicated. And we should be wading through that, engaging in the technologies of self.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very, very useful in those kind of, these things are unavoidable. And I think that the role we need to play is, like, by putting ourselves in proximity to those who are most powerless, that act mm-hmm. is, I think, at the ground of, like, what it is to follow Christ. And I think it brings us to the reality of the incarnation. Because if you're close to those who desperately need power or power of another kind, I think it clarifies the way we think about power in our own lives. And I don't mean using them as a tool. So, oh, good. I'm so glad I volunteered. Now I can think about my own life. But no, it's just this natural outworking.
Yes. And it would
a proximity.
Be, and it would be a real shame, which I feel like this is a natural human instinct, I could be wrong, to use the powerless as a way to make yourself feel better, too. Like,
mm-hmm.
to fulfill the need to control and to dominate,
mm-hmm.
To kind of place yourself in a position next to... I mean, bullying is just like a... To be a bully in some way, I think that that's like a natural instinct to exploit the powerless. And I think that that happens in a self way and in a technology of dominance way. Like, as far as, I don't know, immigration. I mean, any topic we want to talk about, which we don't have to get into the details, but just like, how are we making ourselves feel better by exploiting the powerless?
Mm-hmm.
And that can happen in a, macro and micro way.
Right.
I'm interested in that. That actually makes me think of, I've been reading a lot of Toni Morrison, and I think everyone in our community should read The Bluest Eye and really any novel by Morrison. I think it's timely, and I think she has such good things to say. But in The Bluest Eye, the main character is a young Black girl, and she's the protagonist. And at the end of this novel, if I could read this quote, I think it really flows with what we're talking about. At the end of the novel, the narrator, the speaker, is kind of talking about how the whole community projected onto her and really abused her in a way that was a little bit, like, subconscious or something. Like, they don't know. Like, there wasn't some intentional, like, abuse, but it was like, well, there was actually in the book. But how the system of oppression of people of color really, like, even people of color abusing someone else who's, like, less than them. Because there's, like, this twofold sort of, like, self-motivation, but then being plagued by the system of white power and dominance that causes people in their community to act out, if that makes sense. So, anyway, I want to read this, because I think that that has a lot to do with what you just said, too. So, this is the speaker talking about the protagonist. So all of us, all who knew her, felt so wholesome after we cleaned ourselves on her. We were so beautiful when we stood astride her ugliness. Her simplicity decorated us. Her guilt sanctified us. Her pain made us glow with health. Her awkwardness made us think we had a sense of humor. Her inarticulateness made us believe we were eloquent. Her poverty kept us generous. Even her waking dreams we used to silence our own nightmares, which is a key part of the systematic. And she led us and thereby deserved our contempt. We honed our egos on her, padded our characters with her frailty, and yawned in the fantasy of our strength. And fantasy it was, for we were not strong, only aggressive. We were not free, merely licensed. We were not compassionate. We were polite, not good, but well-behaved. We courted death in order to call ourselves brave and hid like thieves from life. That's the end of that. I think that's just so, I think it's so powerful. And what's powerful about Morrison is she's writing this novel, the speaker is black, and the black community, talking about black community, treating this black girl. And I think that that is so, like, her ability to critique, even in the midst of obvious oppression, and that book was written in the 70s, you know, like, not now, and still carrying over, like, critique her own community for responses to oppression. I think that's so powerful.
Yeah, those last lines are tremendous. I was trying to, as I was, I've not read it, and Bluest Eye, E, play on word, is that E-Y-E, right?
It's E-Y-E.
Okay,
yeah.
Probably. It's such a, so, not compassion, so I'm just imagining our local bookstores are, like, going to get calls on this one. I will be among them. Not compassionate, but polite. I mean, those last few lines, right? So, certainly timely. And, yeah, that those last lines are very useful.
Complicated.
Yeah.
I think the whole concept of, like, how she says, like, we cleaned ourselves on her. And just, I think that has to do with a lot of what we're talking about with projection and with, like,
absolutely,
how we take the nastiest parts of ourselves and we put them on something else. And it may not even be an individual. I think that in this novel, at least, the protagonist, I would argue, is kind of a symbol for literally anything.
Is this like a scapegoat mechanism? Or it's not really that, though, is it? Because this, that's not... Is that embedded in the text? I'm not sure.
Yes, I think so, because I think that, like, the book is, I mean, the protagonist's whole family kind of, like, does this to her in different ways, and I think it's just how each of them individually copes with, like, with racial oppression, with marital control, with psychological disorders, and how they put that on her, because she's this weak, you know, frail, individual, good, simple thing that can be stepped on, like, can be squashed under your dominance. So how everyone feels better when they're in control. And so it's easy to project all the shit that you have onto something else because it makes you feel better. Like, as simple as that, psychologically, you feel better when you get to put it on something else. So I think even politically that's interesting, which we don't have to go into that fully, but how you feel bad, you could have, like, genuine, like, feelings of, like, this is unjust, or this is inappropriate, or with complications with the church and the way it deals with things, this is evil, or, like, this is, but then how do you continue to love and continue to be compassionate instead of polite on, when it comes to people?
And to, that passage is this very useful, very visceral, kind of literary door through which we can think about, when is this us, right? When are we doing
this?
Yes. And when are we essentially taking, essentially being satisfied with cheap resolutions to injustices that we see, as opposed to ones that come at cost?
Yeah.
You know, I think of even voting as a very interesting example of, which I've long thought about how some of the almost religious, sacramental, like, feelings that are associated with voting, where it's like, okay, but, you know, I voted for the right person, so essentially my hands are clean. Right, like, yeah, check, done. You know, like, I am aligning myself with the right group here. Too shallow.
And it's
a way of living.
I voted
in our
for the
world.
Right person, but as far as proximity, I'm so far from the poor.
Exactly.
Or I'm so far from the diverse communities in Springfield.
Yeah.
Or I'm so, and that's, I think we all should be convicted of that.
That's
I don't
right.
think it should get. I don't think it should be a guilt that, like, destroys you or allows you to be, like, immovable.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. I love the comment on proximity, and I think the voting, the, like, exploration of, like, voting and, like, what is that actually doing? Like, I think it is interesting because it can be a way of satiating.
Right, and I think, again, I just go back to, like, I think the response of the mature Christian, like, that's, I'm so interested in these really wonderful people that like make up this our church, who I already respect so much sincerely, but like I'm just so interested in all of us working together to be as mature, grounded, deep as we can, so that we can navigate these times, which are very complicated, in ways that this is not self-serving, in ways that help others.
Yeah.
Right? Like the more complicated the time, the harder it is to serve others well and be clear-headed about that.
Like you can't step.
That's right. And so, you know, John and I were even, I don't know, maybe even not quite debating this last week, but he has this very, I think, unusual, it's a compliment, but like a very radical, unusual kind of ethic of love that I don't really know that I have, which kind of positions him to say, yeah, like, no, like, and he means it quite literally, like the individual that you encounter leaving the grocery store is worthy of it, of your time and attention if the situation presents itself in such a way that like you feel it, you know, you can do that. I don't operate that way. Like this is that's a proximity thing. Like, and I would be much more inclined to make an argument like, actually, like you can be judicious with your time and you're cutting off people so you can focus on the important work. You know, that's like my vote. But I don't know about that. Like there's something that there are so many reasons to avoid being in close contact with those who are in the most need. And I just put myself first on the list of like, mm-hmm. It's very, very easy to like come up with endless reasons to spend years not being in those places.
And I've been very convicted about that as well, especially with my relationship to the poor. Because I think the socioeconomic is really like a base, in my own opinion, like a baseline for a lot of other issues.
I know we're probably heading toward the end of the conversation. I have to recommend a book by Andy Crouch, who is out of Cornell, I think. I can't really say Cornell without thinking about The Office. It is a great school.
Andy as well?
It might be, and I'm like, is that because of The Office? Or? But Crouch is definitely the last name. He wrote a book called Playing God. I don't know what I think of all of this book. It's something like 5 years old, probably more now. He says that, and we probably didn't fully finish the discussion on just how to think about like if power is something to
part two later.
Right, part two, right. If power is something to try to relinquish or what, to repurpose or whatever.
Probably repurpose.
Crouch is really, I mean, I appreciate the book, and I think that the community would find it useful, even if you don't agree with all of it. But he puts this question, he says, who is flourishing? He says this is kind of the guiding question on power. Who is flourishing because I have power? And you can always make the argument like, well, that's like too simple or too narrow a frame. And I don't know. But I think it's a very useful question. Like, I think rather than asking how can I alleviate my responsibility for the power that I have, I'm much more interested in the question of who is flourishing because I have power. Oh, go ahead, yeah.
Is he posing that question as this is a good way to repurpose power, to say like who is flourishing in a way that like allows like, I don't know, you using your power well, like is that why he's kind of promoting that, like to see who's getting positively affected by your power, by the power dynamic or by the leadership?
100%. And I think that he addresses, and it's again, it's been a minute on this book, but like he addresses these very famous kind of rightly important passages in the New Testament about how Jesus empties himself of power, mm-hmm. and how he becomes first one with humanity, right? If we are walking toward God, he is running toward us, which is just something that like as Christians, we have to like allow to remain like kind of in our hearts. Like if you feel like you're even stumbling, crawling toward God, He is, in fact, running toward you. Mm-hmm. Crouch argues that these passages where you see Jesus emptying himself of power, first God becoming human, but then also the time and place that God arrives, right?
Yeah.
And the people with which God communes. Crouch argues that this is, it's actually very much in the vein, in a sense of the vein of Foucault, that he argues that, Crouch argues that, like, it's not that Jesus is powerless, it's a very peculiar, certain type of power that is a creative power, that is all about the reordering of the world. This is, you know, this is very much like Revelation 20, 21, 22, where you see the culmination of human flourishing isn't all of us with no power, it's us ordering the world in a way that is creative and good and ultimately honoring to God, which is, by the way, in the same breath, loving the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, that's saying a lot there, but I think there's something very interesting about how to think about, you know, Jesus at his most, you know, impoverished, at his most persecuted, was also teaching and speaking and reshaping the world. I mean, it's through this other power, this, like, relinquishing of, like, so in other words, I mean, to hopefully, and again, we can certainly disagree on this or have conversation around it, but, like, it's Jesus who's, like, he's putting to shame the powers of the world, right? So Colossians teaches that he's putting to shame the powers and principalities of the world. He's making a mockery of them. And I think that's its own kind of, like, beautiful, creative, Christocentric,
right?
Power,
but still chooses to come and work within them, you know.
Right.
Chooses to,
right,
become and be incarnate.
So I don't know. I don't know that. I just think of that when I think of, like,
oh, I want to tap into it because I'm. Yeah, I want to tap into. I should read the book, but I want to. I really want to know, like, what does Christ say about how to respond, and just how to be. How to use power, how to, like, recognize it, how to not, like, lay down, but, like, when you are feeling powerless, how to, like, utilize that in a creative act to love.
Right.
And
right.
To, I love the comment about flourishing. Because if you are in a position of, even if it's slight power, like, how is someone beneath you or that you're in charge of, whether it's your parent or you're in the workplace, like, flourishing? Like, because then that's an act of, it's not about my dominance and my control. It's about how can I use my position to relinquish that to love others and to, like, be more invested in their flourishing.
So a very practical question for you, as you have, I mean, you were, I think, transparent about, you know, where you're identifying, okay, so why am I trying to grapple for power in this relationship, in this, you know, professional encounter, whatever.
Yes.
As people are hearing our dialogue, what has been most, and again, I know it's subjective, but what's been most useful for you? If you could say, okay, so these practices, whether it's habits of mind or whatever, like, these are useful.
I think...
Or have been productive, and so I've been trying to... Yeah.
One of the most, I mean, this is a simple answer, but, like, externally processing with Jason, like, why am I feeling so anxious about this? Or, like, what about me is causing this? And I think one thing that's been really, I've been talking about a lot with Jason with my struggles with power has been, like, idealism. So one thing we talked about, I remember, that stuck with me maybe a couple of months back was on work and idealism in the workplace. And I think that's just one example for me of something I really struggle with. And I think I struggle with it with friendships too. So, like, viewing people, like, probably wanting them to flourish, but then viewing them in a place they're not at, like, in this ideal space, or, like, viewing the business I'm working at, or, like, the students I'm teaching in this way that's, like, not there yet. So I think that's a relinquishing of control, because I can't force someone into a place they're not at yet. And that's actually not loving and patient and kind. So I just think maybe processing with someone, writing is always helpful, praying and meditating on how am I, like, how could I relinquish control in some areas? Or what am I trying so desperately to control and have power over? And why do I want that? And, like, how could I maybe adjust my perspective on that? which is hard. And I think that, I guess I just do not think without Christ, I could adjust my control with people and with work and whatever other area power manifests itself.
Listen, it was so great talking to you. Interesting, thought-provoking, as I knew it would be, and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeremy.